Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 152 with Miguel Ortega. Lon, you introduced me to Miguel.
Yeah, amazing stuff.
Yes.
What a great guy.
Amazing stuff. And this was part of a movement you were trying to tell me about when I first joined the company. And this is a long time ago. This is how long this thing has been going on.
Yeah.
And it is about, you know, us supporting artists that want to do amazing work, right? And this is something we've always wanted to do. And Miguel is one of those. He's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely insane. And he'll admit it too.
Absolutely.
Miguel and Tran, Miguel Ortega and Tran Ma, I met Miguel at Nomen a few years ago.
Yeah.
And this was soon after the Green Ruby Pumpkin had come out, which was a short film that they had produced for just an amazingly beautiful short.
It was a Thanksgiving themed short.
Halloween.
What did I say?
With a trick or treating theme.
And it's beautiful, beautiful thing.
And so they were talking about doing like the next, you know, this next thing.
Right.
And the next thing was this idea.
But what's amazing, I just want to go back to the Green Ruby Pumpkin really quickly, because it's unbelievably high production on a like a shoestring budget.
Yeah, absolutely.
They do like things that are unbelievable that would normally cost millions of dollars on like $10.
And I, when in the podcast, we learned that that was the first time that he'd ever used Nuke.
Right.
And it's like, it's beautifully composited.
Like, yeah, it's, yeah.
But both Miguel and Tran are, you know, they're
dedicated.
They're dedicated, but they're also, they're creature artists. Like they come up with the most amazing creatures and characters and so on. And they had this idea to create a film about cryptozoology.
Yes, which is a very interesting subject. So cryptozoology is the study of mythological animals.
Yeah.
And some of them have been discovered. Like they talk about the okapi, which is actually, I found out from going from the LA Zoo, it's actually the forest giraffe. It's a giraffe with a short neck. A very fascinating, and apparently most no one knew about it, but someone thought it was a mythological animal and they actually discovered it. Which was the way in this short that he could authenticate that certain mythological animals do exist.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like the known example.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
What's cool about it is like, if we found this, so therefore maybe Bigfoot exists, maybe the Loch Ness Monster exists or whatever, and sort of authenticates the existence of a, like an archaeologist. Although this is for animals, so you can almost think of it as Indiana Jones of animals, right?
Right.
And awesome idea.
Such a cool idea and such a beautiful, visual concept that they've created.
And the animal that they decided to base this first teaser, I won't call it a teaser, or it's episode one is what it's called.
Episode one, yeah.
Is the Nino.
Right, which is as far. I mean, I'm gonna simplify it and say that it's like a Japanese mermaid, but it's much more than that.
It's
this really deep connection to mythology, where there's long lines of apparently people that a young girl who had mistakenly eaten one, like. There she becomes almost immortal and lives for hundreds of years, and the whole family descendants. It's a very complicated
thing that goes
story
generations of families, which is very Japanese type thing, and a beautiful like way more interesting than let's say like well he talks about it like Bigfoot,
yeah, it's a Yeti or right. Loch Ness Monster. It's like no, this is really deep and interesting.
But the point being that basically he wanted to do this story about this guy looking for the Nino, and it's a complicated also period piece,
yep,
right. And he had to one find the funding for it,
yep,
had to figure out how to do it on the limited funding that he got and do it over several years in a sense. And he filmed it all in his apartment. And it's an amazing thesis. So here's my recommendation. Watch the actual piece. So go to the show notes and look at the, we'll put a Vimeo link to the actual piece itself. After you've seen the piece, don't do what I did. Don't look at the making of before. That was a big mistake. But after you've seen the piece, then look at the making of and realize like how much of this was shot literally in this guy's apartment. And you'll be shocked about how much CG is involved and how these guys did everything on a nothing budget.
Yeah. And then listen to this podcast.
But
if you're listening to this podcast and you can't get to Vimeo, just listen to the podcast and then watch the video and the making of.
Yeah.
You'll be fine.
It was, it's amazing. Miguel is such a great guy. He is so hard to get. His mind is scattered all over the place, which is exactly how you need to be to make something like this. And I love him. It's a great, great guy. And it's an amazing short and beautiful. So definitely see that. Okay. Now, just before you get into this, because it's going to be a really great podcast, a couple of things we're going to talk about. Lon, we've got a couple of things that are coming out.
Yeah, so I'm going to suggest that everyone keep an eye out for the blog.
Yes.
Probably, you know, in the next few days after the podcast releases,
yep.
You'll see some new information about what's coming in the next version of V-Ray.
Yes.
It'll be one of the first betas that we think is going to be available with some of the new features, with lots of other new features kind of up our sleeve. But this has got some pretty interesting stuff in it.
We're sort of putting like a little bit of teasers, like, oh, maybe this will be out there. Maybe just, you know, like,
I mean, you know, legitimately, there's new features that we need to get in the hands of people to test as much as possible to, you know, to figure out what bugs we need to fix and everything. But there's some really cool stuff coming.
Yeah. And some of you may have seen, I know there's going to be questions about this because there already are questions about this. Vlado put out a couple of videos on YouTube, just sort of dropped them out there on the internet, sort of like Mike dropped them out there, but of some new real-time denoising stuff going on. And yeah, there's going to be a lot of questions about that. And sort of Vlado and I have been discussing about it and discussing it and talking about how to get you guys more information about it. But yes, there is some really cool stuff going on, especially in the denoising side of things and a few other things happening. But yeah, definitely go to chaosgroup.com and go to our blog section and you'll be getting a lot of information in the coming weeks. I'd recommend you go there at least once a week to check out what's new in that area. And also remember, I'm still asking you guys to rate the podcast and review it on iTunes. This has been a goal of mine. I'm going to do it through the end of the year. And until you don't do it, I'm going to keep asking you guys to do it. but anyway, I appreciate it. And, all right. And, hopefully you guys are getting ready for the holidays. Remember V-Ray makes a great Christmas gift.
Perfect stocking stuffer.
Stocking stuffer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and we'd love to hear more about it. If you guys have any questions, of course, you guys know how to reach us. What's the best way to reach us? Obviously you can reach us at, chaosgroup.com. You can put a comment up on our website if you want to do that. And then you can also go into Twitter. Our Twitter handle is CG_labs on Twitter. And then we also have our Facebook page, which is CG Garage Podcast, all one word. All right. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So Miguel, is your house back to normal?
It's back to normal. Well, I mean, it's pretty normal, but our house is a really weird house.
Yeah.
As is. Like, I have a pretty insane toy collection and pinball machine collection that I've had for years. So when you walk in, it's quote-unquote normal, but it's
right.
Like, It's like the house from the 40-year-old virgin.
It's like Rob Zombie's house.
No, it's like his house is probably way cooler. Mine is just straight geek, like Star Wars and fucking Batman stuff. Like, I'm not even that cool, like with like cool skull. I do have skulls, but it's pretty just straight up geek.
Nice.
Yeah.
So where did you put all that stuff when you were filming?
We put a lot of it away, but a lot of it was behind some of the flats. So
if you just like shoved it
just behind. Hidden behind.
If you look at some of the making of, there's like a life-size Yoda on the side. There's, if you look at the walls, it's full of like Batman animated series cells and stuff like that. So it's there even in the making of. You just have to look on the sides, and right. It's full of geeky stuff. Yeah.
Oh man, yeah. The making of, by the way, so cool.
It's pretty cool. Huh?
So cool.
Yeah, I always like making them, so we really try to always release one whenever we release a project.
Like all of the handwork, when you know, like as you guys were like staining books and stuff like that. Yeah. Just well, all before the work
we
get that went into
we should really talk about how he did this. So let's a couple things first. What like?
Oh, in usual Chris fashion, he's already recording.
Oh, I've already started. Yeah, we're 2.5 minutes into it.
This is the good stuff. Before, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So to. You've been had an interest in doing films for
forever. Yeah,
right. And you went to film school, I'm assuming.
No, I went to Noman.
You went to Noman.
Yeah.
Okay. And you're like, okay, I'm gonna start making films.
Yeah, I just think that when you're a kid, you see. For me, it was Return of the Jedi that I know is the least favorite of the three. But I saw Return of the Jedi and like the Jabba Palace and the Sarlacc Pit and everything. It's like, holy fuck, I want to do the Rancor. You know.
Right.
And then once you start working in the industry, you realize, wait, I don't want to be the guy that just sculpts the Rancor. I wanted to be the guy that said, hey, we need a Rancor. You know what I mean?
You don't want to be handed a picture. Draw what this guy came up with. You want to be the guy that came up with it.
Totally. So, yeah. So I went to Noman, and once I graduated and worked in the industry for a few years, I think it was when I was at Tippett Studios that I was like, you know what I want to do? I want to direct. I don't want to do visual effects only, even though I do love visual effects.
Right.
Obviously.
But you've got it. But having a background in visual effects helps you.
Oh, I think it's like required at this point. I think every director should at minimum take a nuke class. Like I think everybody should know compositing. Yeah. I really do.
It's interesting. My wife was working with a DP, a pretty well-established DP, and he's very proficient in nuke. Like, yeah. And he really knows, he like sets up LUTs. He's like, he shows like, here's how I want the comp to look. It's like, well, I'll just take your comp.
No, I think at this point, everybody kind of has to know that stuff because everything could benefit from just knowing a little bit.
Sure.
Just a little bit of compositing will take you a long way. So.
Yeah.
And on this, you also had to be VFX supervisor as well, right? Like it's.
Well, Tran didn't come today. She's going through some family stuff, but she's pretty amazing. And a lot of this stuff, we didn't know how the hell to do it as we were about to do it. So it's like, okay, we have to do a lecture hall scene and we need like 80 characters with cloth sims. We've never done cloth sims in our lives, right? So it's like, okay, how the hell do we do that? How do we manage 80 different ones? You know, because we didn't do anything with motion capture or anything because we couldn't afford any of that stuff. So it's like, how the hell do we do that? I mean, stuff that's really obvious stuff if you're an animator or whatever, but we never use an Alembic cache. We just stuff that we just didn't know any of this stuff going in. And that's why a lot of this stuff took so long because we are modelers, right? So all of this stuff, you know, and that's kind of why we started using V-Ray to begin with because it was like, hey, we just put a light, we press render, it looks good.
Right.
Awesome. Whereas in Mentoray, it was like, turn on Final Gather, and then you have to put this, and then you have to put that, and then you have to put this, and it was like, what? Right. V-Ray was like, this is awesome. It's for us. It's as simple as can be. It's like a real life. You just put a light. It looks like a light.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So that scene, and I was watching it in the making of, where you're looking down in the lecture
hall. You guys are skipping a whole bunch of points.
Well, now. But I want to realize
I didn't realize that we have been following this project for, what, 3 years now?
Yeah.
And so we're like already way ahead of the conversation.
Well, we'll share the links. Everybody will get to see the final movie, which is amazing.
Yeah.
And the making of, which I think is equally amazing. And, you know, you're talking about the fact that you guys had to fill this, lecture hall. I had no idea that all the people were digital until the making of. And I went, holy shit, I really thought you guys had just like figured out a way to maybe photograph some extras or something like that in there. And because they look perfect.
Right. Because in some of the shots, we did have my brother and three other friends. So it's just jumping around and mixing it up.
Yeah.
Where it throws people off and they're like, wait, those people are definitely real. And then the wides are all CG. And then, you know, so you just kind of. By mixing it up, I think you confuse people in a good way. Like they're not sure what it is.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. They're not paying attention to the same thing. It's always different.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So they're not seeing patterns where they're like, you know what? The character's face is not perfect for whatever reason. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So Chris, we can back up, right? Cause we can actually say,
yes,
you know, The Ninho is out. It's a film that you've been working on. It's a labor of love, obviously. Yes. And you and Tran have sort of dedicated yourselves to it for 3 or 4 years now.
I
remember when we talked in Nomen 3 or 4 years ago, walking around like it was just an
idea. Well, you had shown, I think the first thing that you showed me to Miguel then was the Green Ruby Pumpkin, right?
Yeah.
And so that was a short that you guys did. And that was sort of the precursor of this. Like, look how much we can do with like nothing. Right?
Yeah, and the funny thing about that is like when Tran and I look at that, it's like 2 minutes and 30 seconds, and it's like, fuck, we'll do this shit in a weekend. And that took us forever. But that one, like when we did that, like I truly had never used Nuke ever.
Right.
And you know, Nuke, when you don't know Nuke, is intimidating as hell. There's like, it's like connecting spaghetti together, right? So when we finished that thing, our goal was just to go do commercials. We were thinking small. We're going to do commercials. After a few years of commercials, we'll be able to do like a feature film or something. But then we started getting agents calling us, and we were meeting with.
This is because of Green Ruby.
Because of the Green Ruby.
This is something that a lot of people do. If you do a really, really good short in this town, you're going to get some phone calls.
You're going to get phone calls, yeah.
Right.
But the phone calls could also don't necessarily mean anything.
They don't, so, and that's an important lesson.
That's
right?
An important lesson.
In fact, what was it with? Well, I was talking about with Rory Robinson, right? Mm-hmm. And he was like, "You have to be ready for the phone call."
Yeah.
So when the phone starts ringing, go, "I don't know. I just made a short. You like it?" And it's like, "Okay, where are you going to go from here?" You can't do that. You have to say, "Here's my plan with this project. Here's my plan with 6 other projects. Here's this other script I have ready to go." Right.
Yeah. So when we finished that, we started going, I mean, we went everywhere. We went to Universal, Fox, all, you know, these things we weren't expecting at all.
The water bottle tour.
That's exactly what it's called, because that's what they ask you the minute you walk in. Do you want a bottle of water? And a lot of it was really cool. But what we started noticing is we started getting a bunch of scripts. Just because you get a script, that's the other thing. Just because they hand you a script doesn't mean they're offering you the job. But we were getting a lot of scripts that were pretty terrible. And the way, because the Green Ruby Pumpkin is a bunch of little girls asking for candy, the way I always describe it, my mom, who's, you know, my biggest fan, she knows I love Looney Tunes and animation, and she knows that I also love hip hop. So she would buy me like a hip hop Bugs Bunny shirt. She's like, "Look, it's the two things you love together." And it's like, well, that's the way I could describe the scripts that we were getting. It's like, "Oh, you like kid stuff and you like kind of creepy stuff. Like, check this out." And we'd be like, oh, no, this is not what we wanted at all.
Right.
So, and we were also very realistic about where we were at. And, you know, we would get asked, like, "How do you deal with dialogue? How do you deal with, multiple people?" Because the Green Ruby Pumpkin really is almost like keyframed humans, right? It's very theatrical. It's very choreographed. It's not really like, you know, there's no real dialogue at all. There's nothing. So when we went to do the Ninho, we're like, let's go through the checklist of all the stuff that the producers were concerned about if they were to hire us. So we're like, let's make it dialogue heavy, which it is. It is. It's definitely not a VFX piece in the sense that it's like explosions or anything. It's super heavy on the dialogue. And then we're like, let's make the dialogue in English and let's make it in Japanese just to make our lives harder, right? Let's make it period, which is even harder, you know? So let's just go through a checklist of all the stupid shit you shouldn't do and let's do all of it, right? And that's what we did. So that all of the decisions that we made on the Ninho were to – fill the gaps that the Green Ruby Pumpkin didn't cover.
But you knew it was going to be ambitious.
Oh yeah, we knew.
So the only way to, and this is sort of in the I want to, because this, when did you start? Was it 3 or 4 years ago?
Well, it was 4 years ago, but we worked on it for 3, and the past year we've been doing the festivals.
Right. So 4 years ago is when you started. I'm just doing chronologically speaking, and that's when a lot of the big surge of what's the funding thing you guys used?
Kickstarter.
The Kickstarter stuff was starting in films, right?
Yeah.
And so you guys started as like a get Kickstarter, and you put it out there because you needed money. This is going to be way more ambitious. You needed some capital to get this done. Tell the story about how suddenly, like, it was like, you're not going to make your funding to holy shit, we made our funding, because that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, we thought we weren't going to make it, and we thought it was going to be like our first public shaming, you know, like we're like, fuck, we failed miserably in front of everybody. And we, one of the things that we were really adamant about is never to use the word steampunk. We always wanted to go to the source material, not to, you know, the I don't know. I think cosplay has become a little, sorry, not cosplay. Steampunk has become a little cosplay-ish.
Yep.
And we never wanted that. Like, we always associate cosplay with like someone gluing a gear on a top hat. And it's like, what is that? Why would you glue a gear on a top hat?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, top hats were used.
You wanted it to be authentic.
Yeah, top hats were used and gears were used. But it'd be like, you know, doing in 100 years, doing a period film in 2017 and gluing an iPhone to your ass or something. You know, it has nothing to do with nothing, you know? So we were like, let's try to make it feel really authentic. It's definitely steampunk
era.
But it's more authentic. So,
But the steampunk industry, like the steampunk group, sort of gravitated towards the look.
Oh yeah, okay, sorry. So when we tried to like not use that word, we thought we were failing completely. And I think we had a few weeks left. And when the steampunk community picked up on the Ningyo, they totally. I think we got $40,000 in like two days or something. So. They just totally loved it. Yeah.
Right.
So it was amazing.
So that's really what saved the project.
Steampunk saves our ass. Even
though you're trying to avoid it. Aesthetically speaking, I understand. But that group of people who really loved that aesthetic sort of saw it as like, okay, this is it.
Yeah. But you know what the thing is? That I think they even respected what we were doing because they saw it as like, oh, this is like a serious take.
Yeah, you're trying to be true to it. Right.
We're trying to be super steampunk.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Steampunk that we're like the authentic steam.
Well, it's creature. There's creatures, it's sci-fi, and it's period. So you're not gluing a gear to a top hat, but nonetheless, it's all the things that steampunk people
that
love.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, totally.
So it's a really cool thing. So what inspired the story? How did you come up with this story?
Well, we were like, okay, let's use what we know. And Tran and I have been doing creature stuff for 10 years. So we're like, okay, so creatures. So what would be the obvious thing to do? Let's do something with cryptozoology. We knew that cryptozoology would be, because when we were doing the water bottle tour on the Green Ruby Pumpkin, when we mentioned cryptozoology, they're like, oh, we're working on a cryptozoology thing. And I remember someone was like, I'll tell you my version if you tell me yours. And we would hear that a lot. And every cryptozoology story was the same. It was basically a Men in Black ripoff. It was two guys. One of them is wisecracking. And they're going around shooting monsters, right? And that's like totally what we didn't want. So we started really researching the history of cryptozoology, and we started finding guys like Grover Krantz, who doesn't go back to the origin of cryptozoology. He's more in the 60s, and he became the first like scientific mind that became obsessed with finding Bigfoot. And he was looked at as a kook, and he was a anthropology professor at I think Washington State, and they were like, please, you know, shut the hell up with all the Bigfoot talk. And you would see all the interviews with him, and you could always see that they were kind of mocking him as they were interviewing him. Mm-hmm. And I just saw that as like such a perfect character, you know, like for a hero, you're someone who no one believes in. He's like, I'm going to show you fuckers. He never found it though, but I was like, that's a great thing. And then we also saw these guys in the turn of the century. So that what we consider conservation now is like, let's not go and kill an elephant, or let's not go and let's create national parks. But what people don't really realize or don't know is the national parks were mostly created by hunters to stop the killing of animals, basically to protect the animals from people like themselves. So in the United States, the national parks were created by Roosevelt, who killed 11,400 animals in his tour of Africa. So when you go to the Smithsonian, the natural history museums, a lot of that stuff is killed by the president of the United States. It's 11,000 animals. Think about that. That's insanity. And he went with this guy called Carl Akeley. Carl Akeley was, or is, like the father of modern day taxidermy. So if you look at old taxidermy, they would kill this beautiful lion and they would just fill it up with hay. Mm-hmm. So it looks hideous. This is the first guy to go and like look at the anatomy of an animal, sculpt it properly, and it would look like a living creature. He became an advocate for, you know, the preservation of gorillas in particular. And because of him, there was the national parks in Africa to protect the gorillas and all that stuff. So again, we thought it was so fascinating that these ex-hunters were the guys that were, they had a change of heart and no longer wanted to kill these animals. So we're like, let's grab that kind of mentality and let's combine it with the Grover Krantz character and let's make our hero out of that. Tran is a big on anime and manga and all this stuff. And she started talking to me about the Ninyo myth, which is a very famous thing in Japan. And we were like, this is so much cooler than just Bigfoot, right?
Yes.
Bigfoot is just a hairy guy, right?
Did you hear the story that came out recently about the Yeti?
No,
like,
which one?
Like it's just bear DNA or something?
People were claiming that they had the hair of the Yeti and all that, and they said they tested it and it's all bears.
It's all bears, yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, I know people that if they take their clothes off and run through the forest, they'll look like Bigfoot, right? And that's what didn't attract us to the Bigfoot thing. Right. It's like
It's been done to such a comedic point that you couldn't be taken seriously.
It's taken to the point where there's a beef jerky commercial.
Yeah.
So we're like, okay, what else? Like Loch Ness. We, you know, again, too overdone. And then we saw this. Tran is like, check out this myth. And she told me the story about a little girl who accidentally eats the Ninyo, not knowing what it is. And this storm comes in and destroys the entire town. The father wakes up to lightning and he finds his daughter out, you know, on the shoreline. Vomit is coming out of her mouth. He grabs her, brings her into the shack. The storm is kicking and the next morning everything is fine. The land is destroyed and the little girl wakes up as if nothing happened. And according to the Ninyo myth, she lives to be 800 years old. She gets married and has children and they all die of old age. And after many, many generations, she becomes so desensitized to losing everybody she's loved that she cuts her throat and dies. And then the curse is broken. And we're like, whoa, Bigfoot, naked, hairy guy. This is like the best of Highlander, the best of, you know, Interview with a Vampire, like an old little girl.
Right? Yeah.
And we're just like, that's so fucking cool. We couldn't afford to do that sequence. So we're like, what if we had our hero character, this ex-hunter guy, and he's going around saying, hey, I think I know where this Ninyo is. We should find it and protect it. And the last descendants of this Japanese girl were like, fuck, this guy's going to reveal this thing. We need to figure out where he is, see if this map is real, and basically shut him up. So that's where the Japanese family come in. They are, if we were to look at like the last Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, they're like the keepers of the protectors of the Grail. So
it's an awesome story. I think it's so cool. And
thank you.
Obviously, we'll talk about what's happened since that came out. But let's go back to the idea of how you're going to make this thing. you said okay, your budget was really small.
Our budget was really small. So we got $80,000 on Kickstarter. But if you deduct the Kickstarter fees, the prizes and everything, it's like $60,000, which really is nothing for a almost 30-minute piece, period, and all of that stuff.
Right.
It's insane, actually. So I think the only reason why we got it done is because we didn't think that hard about what the hell we were about to do. And that's how we roll. We just jump in the fire. Like, if you overthink anything, you're just going to be terrified, right?
Yeah.
Like, Tran and I always think about it. We're like, wow. I remember Tran the other day. She wakes up. She's like, I had a dream that we were about to start working on the Ningyo. And I thought about it. I'm like, you know what? I'd rather go to prison for 3 years. You know? I'd rather go to prison. Like, fuck it. I'll be in the yard once in a while. It'll be fun.
You get three squares.
Yeah. But it's, I think if we would have thought this out, like, okay, we're going to have to learn how to use a circular saw. We're going to have to figure out how to put Victorian wallpaper. We're going to have to go on Craigslist and buy antiques and strip the paint and restore the stuff because we couldn't afford to buy anything.
Right.
We had to restore furniture. It's just insane.
So and how did you get all this material? So first of all, you used your house.
We used our house.
For almost all of it.
Yeah, pretty much. Not for everything. So
there's exterior scenes.
Yeah, there's exterior scenes. And there's a couple of cave-wide shots that we shot in a real cave. But we added a bunch of CG stuff to it anyway.
Right.
But yeah, so we when we found that apartment, we were like, this is the perfect place for this, high ceilings. So we turned everything and we started looking at it. We're like, we have stairs, so let's put a cave. We have a bedroom. Let's cut a hole in the wall and we could make that look like it's the exterior. So when you look at – it's funny because a lot of people look at the shot of the guy sitting in his office and they go, it's cool how you made the window up high so it looks like he's in a prison. The reason why it's up high is because that window doesn't go out to the outdoors. It's to the kitchen. So if we made it any lower, it would cut into the sink. So yeah, it's really, really, you know, it's just nuts. Yeah.
So you just cut through your house, made things happen, yeah. Built walls, moved furniture around, painted, created all this stuff. And then Whatever wasn't there, you just made in CG.
Whatever we couldn't afford, because we were really ignorant to a lot of this stuff. So we're like, oh, we're just going to rent a lot of stuff. So we went to a lot of these prop rental places.
Yeah.
And they're really cheap. You could rent the most beautiful sofa. And those prop places have been here for 100 years. So you can get gorgeous stuff. And you could get a sofa for $50 for 2 weeks, let's say. But that sofa is valued at $15,000 and you have to put a $15,000 cash deposit. So all of a sudden you're like, a sofa, an ottoman, you're out of money. You want a Victorian rug? Oh, it's a 200-year-old Persian rug. It's a $40,000 rug. So you know what I mean? So we couldn't rent anything because of the deposit. Yeah, so
even if you get the money back, you just didn't have that much cash.
We just didn't have that cash.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, and it's really scary if you were like, okay, let's put our own money and rent, you know, a $30,000 sofa, you know? Because they could just say, oh, you messed it up.
Right.
Right? And what if you mess it up?
Yeah, well, God forbid something happens, you spill paint on it or whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
So we were like, okay, we have to figure out how to get all of this stuff on Craigslist. And it's not like we could just go to an antique store because that stuff gets super expensive. So we'd have to go on Craigslist and find one piece at a time. And for some of this stuff, there's like museum cabinets that we drove like 6 hours to go get. We had to rent a U-Haul, go get it, come back. We bought from some super weird people where we would show up and we're like, okay, we're here for this thing. And the piece would already be in the front yard. And we're like, oh, this is great. We'll buy it. And she's like, oh, I have some other stuff. And we're like, okay, we'll take it. Can we go look at it? And they're like, oh, you can't come into the house. And we would look at them and they had all this stuff on their face. Their teeth were totally rotten. We're like, oh, there's a meth lab. They're just selling whatever they have, but there's like weird smoke coming out of the back of the house.
I bet you they were squatting.
I don't know what it was, but there was some shady stuff where like, oh my God, this is like, we're in the middle of nowhere. Some of these places looked like it was right out of like a, what's that movie where the cannibals come out from the mountains and eat people. Like, it's like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It looked like that.
Really?
Like in the middle of nowhere where all the signs have bullet holes. It was pretty scary, yeah.
What's the movie what's the guy's name? Is it Vincent D'Onofrio where he doesn't have a nose? Do you remember that one? Because he's like this super like meth guy and he's lost his nose.
No.
Oh, yeah. That sounds like that.
But we probably bought from him. Yeah. Yeah. So we bought as much stuff as we physically could.
Yeah.
Physically and budget-wise. And then whatever we just couldn't do, we had to do with CG.
Right.
So we wanted to make as much real stuff as possible. We didn't go out to make a visual effects show off reel.
No.
Because we knew like, hey, you know what? This is going to take a long time. And one of the things that a lot of people don't realize it don't work in CG is doing a Victorian sofa is hard as hell. If you're modeling it, it's super hard. They're yep. super ornate. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, it's just a sofa. Whereas you could have done a spaceship in the same amount of time and it's like, wow, look at my awesome spaceship.
Right.
But it's just a bunch of clean lines. Whereas a Victorian couch has all this intricate stuff. If you look at some of the doors, like the ornate CG doors that we have, it's all this crazy stuff. And we didn't do a lot of displacements on everything. Everything is poly modeled. To the final resolution that you see. So we don't even subdivide a lot of stuff. It's modeled.
Why?
We just, Tran does a lot of the crazy, crazy modeling and she's just insanely fast.
Mm.
Yeah. Especially at the Victorian stuff. She's amazing.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does she model with?
Maya.
She modeled that in Maya.
Yeah.
I was assuming it was going to be a lot of ZBrush in there.
No, we only use ZBrush for characters.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
and we don't use ZBrush. We use Mudbox for everything.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, the stuff is incredible. And what I also find is very true, especially VFX guys that are going to make their own short or do whatever. They tend to be the most restrained on using VFX.
Yeah.
The most restrained.
Yeah. Economical with what they're going to do. Yeah.
They know it's like, oh, that's a lot of work.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that's one of the things that we really realized is at the beginning, we're like, oh, that's not going to be that hard. We could do that. And I mean with anything, not just VFX, but at the end of this, like we realized anything is a lot of work. Like, we're like, oh, we'll just do this. That's going to be a lot of work.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like it's so easy to underestimate how long things take. Just things take a long time.
Yeah.
Anything. If you want it done a certain level, it just takes a long time.
Yeah, so. I mean, you remember when we were doing IRL and we had a DP with us who, you know, he was not a CG guy, but he was a real DP and we were shooting outside the Jeep. He was like, we just put white sheets back there and blew it out so that it wouldn't look like anything, just looked like it was over bright. And he says, well, I would assume you guys are going to put green screens. Like, no. That's way too much work. You got to key things. You got to put in a background. That's not going to work.
We did a lot, which I'm actually really proud of, is we use black fabric a lot. So we didn't use green screen if we didn't have to. And we would just, I mean, there's a shot where you see the guy talking in the lecture hall and we just would put black instead of green. That way we could use real atmosphere. And then we would just put hints of texture on the black fabric.
Mm-hmm.
And it would just look like there was a highlight of wood. And you just assumed we lit it like Willis Gordon or something. We're like dark and there was, oh, that's a wood wall.
And you just put it like a garbage mat around the guy.
We would do a garbage mat. Yeah.
Right.
Your mind just kind of fills in
the
rest.
Your mind would just fill in the blank. You're like, oh, that's a wood wall. It's just lit really dramatically. And it's like, no, it's actually just a black piece of fabric.
Right.
And that's it.
But because I love the lighting in the whole piece. Was that a positive or a negative from a production standpoint? Like, did it help you guys, or was it hard?
I thought we used it to our advantage. So we only have like 4 or 5 lights that we bought on Craigslist broken. And at the time when I was at Tippett, when I originally bought all this stuff, there was 2 brothers that worked at the shop there. So Tippett Studio still has like a prop shop in a way. And they still shoot a lot of practical stuff there. And Andy that would run the shop, I told him, hey, I bought all these broken lights. Will you show me how to fix them? And he just showed me how to fix them. So we bought we shot it with like a bunch of 1970s Mole Richardson lights, which are, they will outlive us completely. They're indestructible. They're just.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's all we used. We only had that. So we were like, let's do a minimal lighting approach. Let's try to light it. I really like The Godfather, so we were trying to light it like that, very dramatic, atmospheric, and yeah.
That's really cool. And you said I remember you were telling me a while ago that you bought a Red and that like you're going to learn how to reuse that camera. Yeah. That was the goal of this. Yeah.
So the goal was before we left the visual effects industry, we had like a checklist of things we had to do. We had to own the camera. We had to own the lenses. We had to own the lights. That way we didn't have to rent anything.
Right.
And we didn't have to use the Kickstarter money for a camera.
Right.
So you could just blow the money right away. A Red Epic, at the time it was like a $40,000 camera or $30,000. I don't remember, but so we had that before we left, and we owned all the lenses and everything. They're just still lenses. They're not like cinema lenses, but that's what we use. Yeah. So we used only still lenses for everything.
Right.
Yeah.
That's really, really amazing. So, the other thing that was interesting, tell me a little bit about how you shot the outdoor stuff and the car and how did all that happen?
Well, yeah, just again, we were like going back to like the sofa example. It's like, okay, we're going to have to rent a process trailer. No big deal. How much is a process trailer? It was like, I think it was like $400 or $500 a day. That's fine. Whatever. $500 sucks, but let's just do it. And then like, but you need a union driver. Okay, how much is a union driver? It was like $600, $700 a day. And we're like, for a driver? I mean, we're filming this in the middle of the desert. Oh, and you have to have production insurance and a fire truck to shoot in the desert. I mean, if I dropped a nuclear bomb there, it would look exactly the same. What the fuck, what the hell are we going to possibly do?
Right.
So we're like, we're going to have to let's just get a U-Haul truck and throw it on the back of a U-Haul truck. And it cost us $75. And, you know, we just paid our friend to drive and gave him tacos or something. You know, we're like, so $700 a day went to like four tacos. So that was it. Right.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, but where did you get the car? How did that happen?
We had a line producer, Sarah, and she helped us find a bunch of Model T guys.
Okay.
Yeah, and they just brought the Model T, which are a nightmare because Model Ts do not drive like regular
cars. I was going to say, how do you figure out? Did somebody have to give you like training to drive
it? They had to give us training,
I saw on Top Gear, they're trying to drive a Model T. It's like there's like a weird clutch situation. Yeah. So you did drive it in the desert.
We did. So on the wide stuff, we had the actual owner drive it.
Mm-hmm.
So he would drive that. And then on the close-ups, it was just being towed along on the back of a U-Haul.
Right.
So.
Wow. So. And where were you shooting?
I think that was in Soggy Lake, which is a couple hours north from here.
Okay.
Soggy, dry lake or something.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what about talent? Like how often did you have to get them scheduled to shoot? Like did you have to condense all? Because that's tough too, trying to get talent over a specific amount of time.
Well, not just that, but the thing that really sucked is like since we shot everything in our house, we had to build a set, then tear it down and clean up the area and then build another set.
A new set. Oh.
Right? Yeah. So that's why a lot of things took so long because it's like, okay, we have to build this long corridor filled with antiques. And all of a sudden it's like, okay, you got to tear down that corridor. Now we're like, we have a ton of what are we going to do with all of this stuff? And do we get rid of it? What if we need it for whatever other reasons that we had to still hold on to some of the stuff? So we shot some of the early stuff, the stuff that we put on the trailer. And we had a much smaller cast at the time. Once we had cool stuff, it was much easier for us to find not better talent, but more talent. So that's when we reached out to like Louie and Tamlin, who we really wanted Tamlin in particular. Tamlin is the older Japanese actress, and she was in Karate Kid 2. I don't know if you guys remember.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we took Ralph's girl, and she was like, when I saw her as a kid, it's like, whoa. I think everyone my age had a crush on her when they were like, you know, 10 or whatever. So we wanted her in particular. And she agreed because she saw all the footage up to that point. But I think not her, she was amazing, but a lot of the people, when they would come and see how we were shooting, I could tell that they were freaked out.
Right.
You know, that they're like, what the hell is this? This is going to be a piece of crap. Because it really looked just ridiculous. You know, it's ridiculous. Like, it's like, okay, here's the crowd, and they would look, and there's a bunch of hats on sticks, and they're like looking at us, and they're like, what the hell am I doing?
Right.
There's actually one of the extras posted something on Facebook recently. He's like, holy crap, I worked on this a few years ago. I didn't think it was going to look like this. Because I could tell that he was looking around. I was like, okay, I'll do this for money, whatever. You guys don't know what the hell you're doing. So, yeah.
That's amazing. I think it's so cool that you made something out of nothing, you know, like a lot. And that really sort of proves something. What do you think? I mean, obviously the story is great. I think it's a great thing, but don't you think the story of how this thing came to be is almost just as interesting? What?
Sure.
You've obviously now you're almost back on. Well, you got a bottle of water right now, but you're back on the water bottle tour now.
We've been on the water bottle tour for a few months already.
Okay.
So when we finished this, we immediately got the attention of CAA or CAA saw mm-hmm. what we were doing, which was a huge deal for us. So they were very excited to represent us, and they were like, we think we could sell this project. And you know, if you've ever been to CAA headquarters, it's incredible. It looks.
I worked. That was the last building I helped design at Gensler Architecture.
Really? They call it the Death Star.
Yeah, we get to get a big hole in the middle.
Yeah, it looks like the where an evil villain would live. It's incredible. And so we got the attention of CAA, and then they sent us on a bottled water tour, and it was pretty crazy, you know? Like, we're sitting across from, like, Jerry Bruckheimer, and it's just like, he's like, oh, I like the Ningyo. We're like, you're Jerry Bruckheimer. It's pretty cool, yeah.
So what do you think, when you were meeting with all these people, like the Jerry Bruckheimers, what was their reaction? Was it about the coolness of the project, or was it like the fact that you guys did it out of your apartment?
Both, right? Because I think what a lot of them said was like, we've seen a ton of visual effects stuff, but we like the fact that there's like, the stuff that I said that we went through the checklist, how we dealt with actors, the dialogue, that it wasn't just like a District 9 wannabe.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, just special effects for special effects. Like, it's funny, we've lost a bunch of the best VFX awards in these indie festivals to movies that barely have any visual effects at all.
Because they don't notice.
They can't even tell. Yeah. They just think that we're a bunch of rich kids that shot 80 extras in a lecture hall.
Right.
And we've lost, and it's funny, like, we've had, you know, some of the people that actually won write to us and be like, dude, I'm sorry. I feel embarrassed receiving this thing, because they know that we did. There's like 1,000 fucking shots in our thing. And they're like, we literally put like 2 Adobe Illustrator things and we won best visual effects. So,
but it's the best part, in the sense that, you know, that it's really embarrassing if you do the best visual effects at all.
That's the best
no
compliment.
One knows.
Yeah, it's the best compliment.
Yeah, it's the best compliment.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, it's like being a hitman. If no one knows that you did it, you did a really good job.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. But I think that's what they liked, was the fact that we were more restrained on that stuff. You know, restrained to a point. There's obviously, you're underwater, there's monsters and everything. They knew that that was fake. But and then they also liked, obviously, the story. They liked the fact that we shot it, because it shows that we were able to make a lot out of nothing, even on shots that are not CG shots. Just again, like the hats on a stick, you know, like, why? You don't have to make that all CG. Let's just put hats on sticks and have someone move the sticks, and it looks like they're all kind of moving a little bit.
Mm-hmm. It's efficient. Right.
And that's the stuff that when I was seeing like the making of some of the Star Trek stuff, and I see J.J. Abrams just like shaking the camera, I was like, yeah, that's a pretty freaking cool idea, or filming on a mirror or something.
Right.
You know, you don't need everything to be CG.
No.
So, yeah.
You don't. And, you know, I think that if you're just really clever about it and with good editing and just some thought behind it, like you probably locked off a bunch of shot because then you don't have to track things, right? We did.
Most of our stuff is locked off right. intentionally. Yeah,
because then you don't have to track things. And it's like, I just get through this shot way easier.
Yeah.
And it's going to fit and I'm not going to worry about it. But that's awesome to do that. You know, like even when Dan Thrawn said the idea of us crashing that Jeep in the IRL thing,
mm-hmm.
it was like, we just had the Jeep up against the telephone pole, pulled it backwards really slowly, and then reversed the footage and played it really fast. And it looked like we crashed into the thing. And everyone's like, oh my God, you crashed it. No, we didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
We just did our best Jim Carrey Ace Ventura impression where he does the rewind sequence. So you're just crashing backwards.
Yeah. I mean, that's straight up 100-year-old. That's a technique.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't work then.
Yeah, yeah.
It will work now.
Yeah.
So, and then we didn't have to destroy your Jeep.
Yeah.
Did you guys use a lot of smoke machine? Because we used a lot of smoke
machine. We use so much smoke machine that, well, I also teach the...
Is it the mineral oil one?
No, we use this thing called Chavez, which is like a total, like a raver fog machine. So it's not even like a professional one. It's not like the Roscoe ones. But when I teach the demo reel class and the look development class, they all make fun of me, the students, because they always know, we know you're going to say it needs more fog, right? So they're like, let me guess, it needs more fog. And I'm like, yeah, that's right. It needs more fog. Yep. Like, it needs more cowbell, you know, like everything needs more fog.
Yep.
So we used a ton of fog for sure. Yeah.
Well, it just gives depth.
It gives depth.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's...
Just looks nice.
And you could take your living room and make it look huge.
Yeah.
You know, with a lot of fog and a wide lens, it could look huge.
Things get lost in the fog and it just looks great. So we tried to use as much real fog as possible. That's when we started using, if we had green screen and we had a moving camera, that's when we started using like a motion control rig so we could do an atmosphere pass. We were almost like shooting this stuff.
Where did you get the motion control rig?
Kessler came in and they gave us a motion control rig for the project.
Oh,
awesome.
So Kessler Crane, they have this thing called the CineSlider, which is incredible. And we were able to, you know, treat it like, you know, like a John Dykstra shoot. And it's like, let's do the fog pass. Let's do this pass. Let's do that pass. And it was a moving camera and it was awesome.
Yeah.
So it's an affordable, it's not like the what is it, the Moco, the one with an arm.
Yep.
It's just basically a slider with I think it has three axes, but it's incredible.
So three axes head and a slide.
And a slide, yeah.
Right.
So you can get a ton of stuff, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, it looks great, I'm sure.
Yeah. That's in the making of, if you look at, there's a shot of the corridor and you can see all the different passes. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And what about the... all the animal stuff. Talk about some of the animals.
Animal stuff was a pain in the ass. That, I think one of the regrets we have, not regrets, but usually a creature would take around 2 months to turn around. The modeling, the light, the look development, the texturing and everything.
And the rigging too?
And the rigging, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the face stuff. So we had, some of these things had like 400 face shapes.
Mm-hmm.
So we had everything. You have total expression. And a lot of them were used on one shot. So it wasn't efficient. That's one of the things that I regretted. Like I think we overbuilt the creatures. In a way though, if we do anything else with them, like we didn't build them. We built them as if we were building them at Digital Domain or something. We didn't cheap out on them. I think we could have fixed certain things and made them a little bit better, but we went all out on them. That's one thing we'd never done before, was hair grooming.
Mm-hmm.
So we were totally terrified by that. X-Gen was an early implementation of X-Gen, which wasn't as friendly as it is now, and it's not friendly now. So we started using that, and we were concerned about rendering it, obviously, because we'd never rendered fur. But it was actually fine. It rendered fine. We also saw, in terms of V-Ray stuff, we saw huge improvements going back to the fog stuff and just how much quicker V-Ray has gotten and cleaner at rendering fog.
Mm-hmm.
But hair was the one that we were also afraid of, but it did fine. So,
yeah, you guys sort of, you threw everything at it.
We threw, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because you have been using V-Ray since probably the early days of when The early days of three. Yeah. And then you've seen how V-Ray has gotten faster as you've been.
The fog in particular is the one that really is like, oh, you know, at a certain point we were like, oh, let's not map anything on the density. Let's not keep it super simple. Now it's like fog. You know, it's all good.
Right.
And the denoiser stuff is the stuff we started using at the end, and that stuff is pretty amazing.
Then you don't have to worry. You don't have to go as fast.
So that stuff is great. Yeah.
Well, that's cool. Do you have any other weird stories of things that have happened since then?
No, I mean, that's it. Just.
So is anyone biting on this?
So when CAA, they started sending it out and we started meeting with everybody. So we have a producer. We're turning it into a feature. So right now, I can't say who it is. Mm-hmm. But it's right now we're looking for writers. So they sent us a list of writers that they like. Mm-hmm. And again, the list of writers is not like the writer of, you know, a blockbuster tentpole. It's like, I wanted the writer that does like a biopic on a president or something. Mm-hmm. Like, we wanted character driven writers. We wanted the writer that would complement our skills.
Right.
Right. So we're like, we'll bring the spectacle. We want somebody that compliments our stuff. So we're meeting with a bunch of writers next week and hopefully lock that down. And once we have the writer locked down, that's when we'll do the press release of who we're doing this with.
Wow.
That's so cool.
That's really cool. When do you think this is all going to happen now?
Well, it's happening already, but you know, you never know. This stuff is...
Because it could go on forever.
It could go on forever. So like our goal as the script is being written, we want to start working on something else already.
Of course.
So, but yeah, it's scary whenever we're not the ones doing it all.
Yeah.
Right. You know what I mean? So as soon as we're like, okay, we have to hire a writer, we have to wait for them to read the script, and like a week or two passes, we feel like, oh my God, what's going on? Because mm-hmm. we're not used to, mm-hmm. you know, passing the work on to anybody.
It's funny. Yeah. You know, like for example, I talked to Rory Robinson quite a bit, and he did something not dissimilar from you with the Leviathan project, right? Yeah. And so, and that, you know, same kind of deal, got an options, going through writers, et cetera. Well, that whole writing process is still going on.
It's still going on.
You know, and it's been several years now. Yes. And he's like, yep, it's still happening. It's not dead at all. It's just like, no, we went with one direction. Now that didn't go that well. So just getting the show and showing it to someone is like the first step and the easy step. And then you have to deal with the serious politics and all that other stuff.
That's what's scary, because you think like, okay, you get an option. Wow, you made it. And it's like, you didn't make shit really. Like you're just in the game now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And now it's like, now is the script going to get written? Is the script going to be good enough to go to the next level? Mm-hmm. Is the distributor going to want it? There's still a ton of chances that nothing even comes of it. Hopefully, you know, the producer that we picked him because of the track record that he has and his commitment to getting this thing done and streamlining it. So
are they looking to do it in a similar way that you guys are doing it, where they're trying to really keep it lean and lean,
but we're not going to shoot this in our house. Yeah.
No, of course not.
Not that lean. But yes. No, they definitely want it. You know, I don't want to say a number, but it's, you know, it's not like a $10 million thing. It's much higher than that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I get it. But that, yeah, they still want to say is like, listen, this is a guy who can create really amazing imagery with like a very low budget, right?
Totally. I mean, that's why we're getting in the rooms with these guys anyway.
I love stories. Like who, what's the guy's name? Gareth
Edwards.
Yeah. I mean, when his story of how he shot Monster is amazing.
Yeah.
I think they shot the whole feature film for $50,000.
Yeah.
And it basically three people in Mexico. Do you remember that story?
Yeah, of course.
It's incredible. That's the kind of stuff that I love is people with that kind of vision, which you have as well, where you're like, cave? I'm just going to have a door. Yeah. And we'll just put the background in there and it'll be fine. You know, yeah. Like just that's all I need.
Yeah.
And so I think that those types of visions are really amazing. And what I think is also really important about it is that those are the types of stories I think are going to get people to appreciate visual effects more. Yeah. Because that's the really the thing where everyone's been coming down on visual effects because they're overused or whatever. Those types of visual effects, I think, are more incredible, especially since you're blending it. You're doing it. I got some hats on sticks and I got some CG guys.
Yeah.
I got it all working together and so let's see what happens.
Well, that's why we always try to do these making of videos to put a face on it and to give you context. It's like, you know, when people look at it, it's like, don't compare this to Rogue One, you know, not Rogue One or whatever, mm-hmm. because it's like we have extremely limited, you know, resources right. here. Don't compare, like a lot of stuff where like, you know, we wish we could have done the scene of the girl with the storm in Japan. We just can't do that. Or we wanted to show the hunting of the Okapi. We couldn't do that. So I think it's important to make these making of so that people see that visual effects artists are not, I think part of the reason why CG is not respected is because companies emphasize the technology over the artist too much. Do you know? And when they,
yes,
they're like, oh my God, we did this with motion capture or whatever. And it's like, you know, that stuff is only taking you so far if you don't have an amazing animator to clean that up and to do something else.
Thank you, Andy Serkis.
Yeah. No, but you know what I mean? So I think that we need to have that. That's why I really respect Gareth Edwards' stuff, because he's – what I like about him in particular is I feel like he's a VFX soldier, not just like a general just barking orders.
Oh, yeah.
Like he can get down on the box.
That's what he did. That's what he did. He like literally had a – he had 1,000 shots to do on Monster, and he just sat there in his closet for a year and just start – and he didn't even know how to use 3D Studio, and he did it all 3D Studio. Like,
But that's the best way.
It is. But there's another thing that I think is important. If you're going to do like a big feature film, you have to figure it all out before and then shoot it that way, right?
Yeah.
What you did and what Garrett did is like, I don't know, let's try something. Maybe it'll work. Yeah. There isn't in actual production of real films, there's no like, let's try something. Maybe it'll work. Ah, it didn't work. Okay, let's try something else.
Oh, you know, one of the things that we started doing a lot towards the end on some of our most successful shots is we would, before we shot anything, green screen or not, we would build the set in CG. We would put like the Mudbox default guy in there. We would light it. And then we would look at it. We're like, now we need to shoot the green screen element to match what this Mudbox stand-in guy looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So it would totally blend in completely because we're now doing it in reverse. We're doing the CG before we're doing the green screen.
Right.
So
you had your set already.
Yeah, we had your set what CG. We wanted to look like.
Right. So then you're like, okay, and then you put the guy in there. It's like, that's how our guy should be lit.
That's how our guy should be lit. It shouldn't be overlit. That's exactly, because it's kind of silly that if you think about it, a lot of times a green screen is done before the environment, and it's the environment is taking up 90% of the image. Why are you lighting the guy?
Because that's what they always do.
But do you see what I'm saying? Yeah. It's kind of crazy.
Although, I tell you what, I've had this discussion with my wife. She does visual effects. Like, European DPs and European films, they always light for the environment. Yeah. They always light for the surroundings. American films, especially comedies, it's like whoosh, all the light on the character. It's all about that character. The background is just blur. Might as well be a green screen and no one will even notice.
Yeah.
So they always light for the characters here. But so what you did was a much more European style lighting.
We like darker lighting.
Yeah.
You know, I like Deacon stuff. That's the stuff that we were really trying to match. Is like again, Godfather, like Gordon, I think it's Gordon Willis.
Mm-hmm.
Deacon stuff where it's more in shadows and so.
Yeah, I think it was great. I mean, I barely knew what it's about. When I first started at Chaos Group, I didn't really know. And you're telling me, I was like, there's this guy, Miguel. He's doing this amazing stuff. You remember he did the Green Movie Pumpkin? He says, oh, yeah, that's great. And says, well, you totally want to support him. So we've been really excited to see the progress of this and really excited to see that it's been done at this point. So
do you think, and you might not, you probably don't even know yet, but do you think that the vision for the film – like, is there stuff that you're looking Like, there a lot? Is it going to be similar to the story?
Yeah. So there's things that we definitely So we wrote again because we're so controlling with everything we do. When we are hiring this writer, we're giving a 62-page treatment.
Okay.
So it's like, this is the story of everything, every character, where we pulled every character from. So in case they see one of our ideas and if they don't like it, if they see where we pulled that idea from and how it's tied to a historical event, all of a sudden they're like, oh, that is a really important part of the history of cryptozoology or the Okapi or whatever. So all our stuff is reverse engineered from historical stuff. So you can't say you don't like that idea because that's what really happened, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, oh, I don't like the beginning scene where they're going through, you know, Africa to hunt the Okapi. The Okapi is the first, you know, modern day cryptozoological animal cryptid that was caught, and it's still used as a symbol for the International Society of Cryptozoology. That's the thing that the guy's looking at in the beginning of the Ninho in the display cabinet. That is the symbol.
They still exist, though.
They still exist.
Yeah, there's one at the LA Zoo.
But when they found it, they thought it was the unicorn of Africa. They was like, oh my God, it's real.
Right.
And they pull out a gun and shot it. So for all they knew, that was the last one, or there was two left. Yeah. Now you just killed the wife, right? So when we give this treatment, all that stuff is in there. Yeah. So there's a few things also that we were really adamant about. We wanted to make sure that when we turn this into a real film, it's not whitewashed at all. So we want, you know, an Asian cast. We want it to be, ideally, I don't know if this part will happen, but I want the Japanese parts to be in Japanese. So my dad was a huge World War II fanatic, and whenever the Germans would start talking in English, he would start screaming at the TV, you know, like in World War II movies, like, that's so stupid. So it was like, okay, if there's Japanese actors, they have to speak in Japanese. So he wasn't
a fan of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Don't some of them speak in German? No, they all speak in English, huh? They do.
They speak in English too, yeah, but then sometimes they speak in German, but apparently they're German. I work with a German guy, and he was like, their German is just terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, someone told me on Facebook
that, even the German accents are terrible.
Yeah. Well, someone told us that some of our Japanese feels American Japanese, the accent.
Right.
And I was like, come on, guys, give me a break. Like, I have no idea.
Right.
You know, like, I have no freaking clue. Like, when we wrote the script, we had to write it in English, in Japanese, and then in, I don't know, what's it called when you, like, spell out the words in Japanese, but they're in English? What is that, like a...
Spell out the words in Japanese.
I don't know. Like, what it sounds like in
Japanese. The phonetic.
Oh, so using the phonetic version. Yeah.
So we had a phonetic version of the script. So we had three versions of the script.
Right.
So because if I'm on set or when I'm editing, I have no freaking idea what the hell they're saying.
Right.
They could just be trolling me the whole time. They're saying, fuck this guy. Right? So
That'd be an awesome short.
That'd be an awesome short.
just the fact that they're saying something else.
Totally. And, yeah. 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 So yeah, that was a big thing, was just casting in the feature film version.
That's got to be hard. I was thinking about it, like, you're hearing what they're, you don't understand what they're saying, so you don't know if they're emphasizing the right word or how they're getting the mood across. Yeah.
So we had to have a translator on set every day that would stand next to me, and he'd be like, that take was wrong.
Okay.
And then he would pick which ones were the best takes. And then I'd have to look at them and be like, if that was the right best performance, because because it was the best version of Japanese doesn't mean it was the best take.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it was tough. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that's really cool, dude. Well, we're just about an hour, so it's perfect.
What's next?
What's your next thing? Besides waiting for your press announcement.
Besides that. So the big thing is that, we'll see how that goes. And right now we're trying to not come up. We already have an idea. So we want to do similar to like what Monster did. We want to try to do a feature film that we could do for a very small amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
So we're developing that so that worst case scenario, we'll make our own feature.
Right.
Because if you have a feature, you have much more power than if it's just a short. Right now we're just proving to people that we could make a feature.
Mm-hmm.
if the Ninja was a feature already, we could sell it. And I think that...
Do you think places like Netflix or stuff would take shorts?
I don't know. I wonder. It'd be cool, but I don't know.
I mean, I could actually see a Ninja TV show.
Like it a feels series. More like a TV show the way we shot series, it.
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea of like, you could be going after different cryptozoological animals and so on.
I will guarantee you, because this happened to a friend of mine where he had this really great short that he did, and it's a very similar thing that happened to him. And they're like, how about a TV show? And he was not necessarily a fan of doing TV shows. And so, but he had to do it. He had to like come up with the whole thing about it. But it could be an amazing TV show. I could see people getting into that for sure.
We wrote out a Bible for a TV show. So we actually did do some meetings for television, not with Netflix. And the idea was that, I mean, I actually think this would be super cool. And some of this stuff is in the treatment for the feature, but we thought you could do an entire episode just on the development of the diving suit.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we put this in the treatment for the film where you would see the failed attempts at using the diving suit. So the diving suit that we used is based on this suit from these two French brothers called the Carmonneau brothers. And you could see it in the Nautical Museum in France, and it weighs 850 pounds.
Right. That will sink.
But there's also no rubber anywhere. So the only thing keeping the water from coming in is the friction of metal, just basically, you know, hitting each other itself. So we're like, this is insane. Like, let's do an episode where we just see them trying it out on a little lake first, and let's see all the failed attempts. And you had to get welded into these suits. We're like, how cool would it be if the water starts filling up? Now that 850-pound suit weighs 950 pounds, and they pull you out, but now they have to unweld you, and the water, you basically drown on the shore.
Yeah, yeah.
So we could do an entire episode on that, and at the end you would catch the Ninja. Season two, you could go and find, you know, some other creature. So we started looking at some of the cryptids in the United States, and we started putting some of that stuff in the short. So when you're seeing him walking around the cave, there's these giants, and we started seeing how there was giants supposedly in Utah. There's these red-haired giants that were in war with the Native Americans at the time, and we're like, wow, how do people not know about this? This is so fucking cool. Whether or not it's true is a whole other thing, but mm-hmm. It's just such a cool idea. So we're like, let's put that stuff in the short just so people go, wow, what the hell are those giants? And you could go into that season two or whatever.
Right.
So that would be the idea, yeah.
Yeah.
If we did that.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff you can do. It could be
really. A lot of stuff. Yeah, so it's what I tell people, it's Indiana Jones, but instead of Judeo-Christian stuff, it's finding cryptids.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, man. It's been awesome seeing that. And people can go to your – obviously, we'll put links to your site and to the Ninja stuff. It's going to be – it's on Vimeo. Anyone can watch it now, right?
Anyone could watch it.
And they're watching the making of as well.
Definitely watch the making of, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great making
watch of. Watch the short first and then the making of. I did it the other way around because I thought our news, like, I really should have watched it the other way around because I was just excited to see the making of.
Yeah, definitely watch it the other way. Yeah. And, yeah, and let us know what you think. You know, write us and tell us if you liked it.
Yeah.
You know, so it'd be cool. Share it. Sharing it is people don't realize the importance of sharing it. It's a huge deal. Sharing it is when we look at all our views, it's all from Facebook shares. So definitely share it. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Cool.
So all right. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Miguel.
Congrats again, man.
Thank you.